Michael Griesbach, my guest for the next 2 hours on the show as we continue investigating the case of Stephen Avery as featured in the documentary series on Netflix, Making a Murderer. Michael wrote a book called The Innocent Killer, a true story of a wrongful conviction and its astonishing aftermath. It's a story of one of the nation's most notorious wrongful convictions, that of Stephen Avery, a Wisconsin man who spent 18 years in prison for a crime he did not commit. And 2 years after he was exonerated of that crime and poised to reap millions in his wrongful conviction lawsuit, Stephen Avery was again arrested for the exceptionally brutal murder of Teresa Halbach, a freelance photographer, and she had gone missing several days earlier. The innocent man had turned into a cold-blooded killer, or had he? This is the narrative nonfiction that's finest, a true crime thriller, The Innocent Killer, a true story of a wrongful conviction and its astonishing aftermath. Michael Griesbach continues with us this hour and into the next hour. Stick with us. This is an intriguing show with a lot of twists and turns. This is something M. Night Shyamalan could only dream of. This is Coast to Coast AM. There is, without a doubt, a free man in prison when Stephen Avery is incarcerated for a crime he didn't commit. I mean, no doubt, this was an innocent man, and yet the real perpetrator free for another 10 years, Michael? Is that what you said?
Yes.
10 years. This guy roamed free. And I thought it was fascinating. You see this documentary series, and the first episode is really kind of about the first case. And, you know, Stephen Avery comes out and hugs Penny and accepts her apology and accepts it. And it seems like he's got his life on a good path. He's made some choices in the past that he's owned up to, mistakes that he made, admits to bending the law and breaking the law on a few occasions for breaking and entering and theft. And I think he had thrown a live cat into a fire or something along those lines.
Yeah, a little bit explained as sort of an accident horsing around with friends in the documentary, but actually doused the cat with gasoline and threw it in the fire.
Yikes. So there's not this real clear-cut innocent cat that we, you know, are led to believe so much in the movie. But, you know, okay, everybody has a past, everybody makes mistakes, and here he's living this clean life. Then all of these people involved in this case are now being called to have to maybe pay the price for what they did in putting him away. And they are being brought in and deposed, and all of these big names that were part of that original crime are literally in a world of trouble because of this lawsuit. And what were they asking, $35 million in damages?
Yeah, $36 million, but even if he got half that, you know.
Right. So you've got all of this going. His life does seem to be improving. And talk us through what happens next. What is the crime that allegedly took place?
Teresa Halbach, the freelance photographer who was from a little city close to here, about 30 miles from Green Bay, went missing on October 31st. Of course, it has to be Halloween. This is the Avery case, and everything weird in the Avery case, everything that could possibly be strange is strange in the Avery case. So it was on October 31st of 2005, about 2 years after Stephen Avery was released, that Teresa Halbach, this wonderful young lady and freelance photographer, went missing. And within 3 days, her parents reported her as missing because she had not called, and that was rare. And about 4 days after that, Teresa's RAV4 SUV was found concealed under some branches at the edge of Mr. Avery and his family's salvage yard, this rural salvage yard that the documentary did such a good job as portraying. I mean, it's a creepy place. It's hilly. There's grass growing over the cars. It's something else. So her car was found there. I was actually called out to the scene because I was on calls, on-call district attorney that day. So before Teresa's remains were found on that property later, I was there and I witnessed just a bizarre, scary amazing scene that started out as a clear autumn day, pretty warm for Wisconsin standards. At that time of year, it was probably 50. Media helicopters searching over, because word had dropped out by this point that Stephen Avery was the last person known to have seen Teresa Halbach alive that day, because he had called her employer, the Auto Trader magazine, to come out and take a picture of a car he was putting up for sale. So the media helicopters, as soon as her car was reported having been found there, were all over the place. And there were probably dozens, almost 100 police officers searching. And a warm day turned into a cold, driving rain. And at nighttime, there were dogs, police dogs, barking. And apparently they hit on this fire pit, and Teresa's remains were found then, at which time I backed out of it, and my boss backed out of it, the district attorney's office backed out of it, and supposedly the sheriff's department backed out of it too, although they were going to assist. So Stephen Avery, within a week, was charged with the horrendous murder and mutilation of Teresa Halbach. As bad of a crime as you can imagine. I mean, Jeffrey Dahmer type stuff, another Wisconsin product. Really horrendous stuff. So then it hits the fan even worse than the wrongful conviction case. Here you've got this guy, once exonerated, once a hero, once a victim of the criminal justice system, overnight turning into a monster, at least in the eyes of those who assumed right away, based upon, you know, not knowing everything. People do tend to assume police get the right guy. He was the last one, you know. So overnight in Wisconsin, anyhow, he was viewed, he went from a victim to a villain.
And with this crime being so brutal in nature, and the fact that they find the RAV4 on the property, they find the body parts in this burn pit, it seems on the whole that this is a pretty cut and dry case of,
well, yeah,
of what's gone on. I mean, to start buying into conspiracy theory at this point with a glossing over of the look is pretty hard. You're pretty hard pressed to start to believe that. Why do you think that people automatically turn to the immediacy of it being a conspiracy? Or did it take a while? I mean, the documentary makes it seem like right away it's called out as there's possible tampering. Is that the way it really boiled down?
No, I think at first most people, because they had heard on news accounts that Stephen Avery specifically asked for Teresa Halbach, the girl, as he put it, who had been out there last time. And in fact, he had concealed his identity on a Star, what do you call it, a 67 or
whatever. Star 67, right.
67. He left it as his female cousin, so that Teresa, presumably, that's the state's theory, you know, wouldn't know that it was a male calling, because she had been creeped out on an earlier incident when she was over at that residence, Stephen Avery's, the salvage yard, and he appeared at the door wrapped only in a towel. So I personally believe that he essentially, you know, got her out there under false pretenses. And so people knew that. They knew at least that he had called for her, and they knew that her bones and her remains were found there. They knew gradually that there was other evidence. Blood evidence came in pretty quick, I think, that his blood, was found in her car. So you get those facts, and at first I think, yeah, it was pretty well, very well concluded, I think, among people in Wisconsin or anybody that looked at it. Boy, he sure sounds like he did it. But then some other things started dribbling out that turned that on its head and had many people wondering, including the fact that the two officers who found the key, Teresa's car key, in Avery's bedroom, had been recently deposed in his wrongful conviction lawsuit, and they were Manitowoc County officers who didn't belong anywhere near there. They were assisting, is for my firm belief, the Calumet County Police and other counties, smaller counties, but Manitowoc County should have, you know, entirely removed itself, the sheriff's department, from the crime scene, but they didn't. Thus, they set themselves up, in my opinion, for being blamed for planting evidence again.
Explain to the listeners who might not understand why, I mean, it took place in Manitowoc County. Why wouldn't the Manitowoc Police and District Attorney's Office be involved in investigating that call?
Right. Well, right off the bat, we, that is the district attorney and myself, there's five in our office, but the two of us, really, I handled the exoneration years ago because he was brand new and I was still helping him on cases once we got to this point 2 years later. We recognized right off the bat that we could not do this, that it would, you know, with a lawsuit pending against Manitowoc County, there could be a, you know, there would be a conflict of interest. The other side would cry foul on anything we did. So we, as soon as Teresa's remains were found, backed off. And Ken Kratz, the now famous Ken Kratz, Calumet County DA, was also out there at the scene. And he had already been, as his police agency, been working on this because Teresa's from Calumet County. So Kratz, the Calumet County DA, now has the case. So we recognized very clearly early that we don't belong in this prosecution as the prosecutor. So they were appointed special prosecutor. Sheriff's Department, unfortunately, and you know, it would have been ideal, and they should have just completely backed away. Instead of the idea was apparently our sheriff's department, and they're separate than us, but our sheriff's department, their policy was Manitowoc County officers will never be alone during any search of this huge, you know, area that the search went on for a couple of weeks. They can assist, but there always has to be a different jurisdiction's police officer with them. There. Now, in retrospect, I think they wish, obviously, that they never even would have set foot on the property again. But these are small police agencies around here. Calumet's much smaller than Manitowoc. So I suspect that's why they, you know, they still involve themselves in helping out the investigation. And indeed, their officers, Lincoln Colburn, found some of the most incriminating evidence. Which sure makes people scratch their heads, and I get that entirely. I get that.
And it is. It's pretty damning evidence, and it's funny that, now talk to me, when this happens, he's arrested, or he, you know, they go out and investigate, they get the warrant to search his property.
Mm-hmm.
How long is a search warrant good for?
Well, it depends. I mean, usually we'll get a search warrant and the police execute it, and within a, you know, it takes them 5 or 6 hours, or if it's a murder investigation, it might be a couple days, you know. Here, it took, what, weeks, 2, 3, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, I don't know. I think they renewed it once. And the lawfulness of it depends, and this was an issue up on appeal in the Avery case, already decided against Avery. You have a salvage yard that's, I don't know what it is, 100, not 100 acres, but I think it's 60 acres. You have a bunch of outbuildings. You have, so it's the size of what you're searching and what you're searching for, and they have to determine if that's a reasonable amount of time is the ultimate question. And, of course, Avery's locked up, not locked up, but he's up in his cabin, family cabin up north, calling in live to the Nancy Grace show, incidentally, proclaiming his innocence way back then. But the police have, I mean, to be fair, look, you know, I got no irons in this fire. It is what it is. Whatever happened, happened. But he wasn't around, and they had access. They had his, you know, it was, the police had days, if not weeks, to search this premises. Now, we can all, conspiracy theorists, say, oh, that, look at that, that means that they planted evidence, and it means that Stephen Avery didn't do it, which actually are two different questions if you think about it. But it could also mean that they're doing their job. You know, they're trying to find out evidence, if there is any evidence. So,
but knowing what you know about the first case, you right. don't find it strange that they go in, they investigate numerous days, nothing is found, and then all of a sudden, bam, as soon as the one cop who's been deposed and who was not supposed to be in there alone is in there alone, suddenly he finds the key. That just, well, I mean, that just rings, yeah. So
well, Dave, to be ugly. Clear, I mean, they did, it is ugly, and it looks ugly, and part of it is ugly, but part of it's not. They did find the car right away. The blood was there. It had to be tested by the crime lab, but the blood was in the car right away. The key is very troubling, and it looks really bad. And it's either that police did what Netflix is essentially convicting them of doing, planting evidence to strengthen their case or to even get somebody again who didn't do it, or it's just really bad luck that the key wasn't found by the smaller community, Calumet County, and it took till it was a fifth search, I think, before it dropped out of something. It couldn't look worse. I couldn't, you know, I agree with you completely.
Well, you've watched it was planted. You've watched the documentary. They not only went in, but many police officers said that they looked at it, that nightstand. They pulled everything off of the nightstand. They put everything back onto the nightstand. They shifted the nightstand, nothing there. Then all of a sudden, there it is. Where did it fall from? Where did it come from?
Well, I believe they showed the nightstand, and it's kind of like a bookcase, empty. But my understanding, and I did not prosecute the second one or the first one because there was a conflict, and I wasn't here in the first one, thankfully, so I didn't wrongly convict Mr. Avery either time. And I don't believe he was wrongly convicted the second time. My understanding is that bookshelf was still full of books when the Manitowoc County officers moved it. It was up against a wall. And the Netflix documentary showed it empty as if the key was plainly there to see. And they moved it. You know, our cops moved it, Lincoln Colburn, picked it up, and while they moved the bookcase, apparently, is when the key fell, this is their testimony, from, I don't know if it was in a book or somehow up there and hadn't been located earlier. Now, there was a Calumet County officer in there. However, you know, as you saw in the Netflix documentary, he said, yeah, I was there because that was the deal, no Manitowoc County officers alone. However, they said on cross-examination, this young Calumet County cop did, that, you know, of course it's possible, it's not entirely impossible that they could have planted the key. So it looks, it's either incredibly bad luck, incredibly horrible, another bad coincidence that has plagued this case, or they planted the evidence. There's only two choices, and I do not believe they planted the evidence. I will say in a weird way, though, here, if you think about it, even if they planted the evidence, it doesn't mean, and there's no excuse for planting the evidence if they did. It's a crime. It's obstruction of justice. It's misconduct in office. But even if they did, it does not mean that Mr. Avery was not the killer.
Did they take a serious look, though, at other potential perpetrators in this, or was it happened at the Avery location? Stephen Avery was the guy that called for her, and he was the last one she was seen with. Was there anybody else, family members, that they thought maybe we should look at Bobby, maybe we should look at the dad or the mom? I mean, was there ever any chance that it could have been anybody besides Stephen? I mean, the way they paint it is the whole family's a little shady, according to the Netflix documentary. And that that this family is not the cleanest cut family on the planet. This isn't the Cleavers we're dealing with.
No, a couple of the brothers had sex assault convictions in the past. They took DNA swabs of everybody that was on the property that day, which included a whole slew of Averys, including the brothers, Chuck and Earl the Pearl, as we call him in the office, and Bobby Dassey and the other Dassey. And so they did do I'm sure they suspected that Stephen Avery was their number one suspect. You know, they'll try to, during press conferences, well, he's no more of a suspect than any of the other Averys or anyone else. Well, come on. I mean, he's the one that called her out there. They do themselves a disservice by not being straight, frankly, way back then. But they did do DNA swabs. They did interrogate all of the other people, and the evidence came back in all kinds of ways to no other person other than Stephen Avery.
Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll continue with the case of Making a Murderer here on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue with our guest, Michael Griesbach, as we discuss the Stephen Avery case, the murder of Teresa Halbach, and the inadequate investigative practices that the police used in the second case. And where are the flaws that our guest sees, and where are the strengths to this case? We'll discuss that and more right here on Coast to Coast AM. Michael Griesbach, my guest this evening on Coast to Coast AM. He'll be with us through the remainder of this hour and into the next as we explore even more of the inconsistencies in some of the case that was presented in the Netflix series. Dan O'Donnell will join us in that hour as we discuss his podcast series, Rebutting a Murderer. Michael, there's so much weird aspect to this story. So many weird twists and turns, ins and outs. Let's talk about a few of the ones that you, looking at this from the outside, that do seem pretty sketchy to you. And I mean in the sense of, these are some of the points they brought up, Dave, that yes, I agree, this does make Stephen Avery look pretty innocent of the case.
Well, I'll start out with Brendan Dassey's confession that troubled a lot of viewers of Netflix and frankly troubled myself and my family as we watched, as we binge-watched the show like everyone else did.
Right.
You know, they use this technique in law enforcement. It's called the Reed technique, R-E-I-D, after some guy named Reed in Northern Illinois. I don't know if he's a psychologist or a retired cop or both, but it's basically designed to elicit a confession as opposed to find out the truth. So it sort of, you know, it assumes that police know the truth. They know what happened ahead of time, and which is a bad place to start because, you know, you got to keep an open mind. But the intent of it is then to get the defendant to confess as opposed to find out what the defendant knows or the witness knows, which means you can use all kinds of really manipulative techniques. You can lie, you can fib, you can, you know, manipulate, endear yourself with the person by saying, you know, we're here to help you. And it's used all over the country. Now, when it's used with a kid like this, obviously low functioning young man like Brendan Dassey, it's very troubling to watch, and it really it's raised a lot of questions in people's minds about whether, you know, how reliable is this confession. So there's one thing I'll give the documentary, that it's raising awareness of that really important issue, whether that's the way we want our police to interrogate subjects. So far, the courts, you know, all across the country, courts have said, no problem with the Reed technique. That doesn't violate a person's constitutional rights. That's an admissible confession. But, of course, Mr. Dassey's case is now on appeal in federal court in Milwaukee on that very issue, whether that confession was coercive. So, you know, they make a pretty good case that whether Dassey's confession is accurate or not is up in the air. And if that's not accurate, well, you know, exactly what did happen to Teresa Halbach.
Nancy Grace came out in the last few days, and she's talked about the fact that when they brought up the coercion, she said, how is what they did to him coercive? There was no threats. There was no beating. Well, but maybe I've got this wrong because I'm not an attorney. I just like to pretend I am when I watch Matlock. But isn't coercion the idea of drawing out from somebody or even browbeating? And yes, I understand you want to ask a question. You want to ask it multiple ways and multiple days to try to elicit some kind of response from this person. But when you're asking a series of questions and when the person says, yeah, this happened, are you sure this happened or did it happen this way? Yeah, that's the way it happened. You know, and they give the new version. It seemed very much like in a court of law, as an attorney, you know, right? If I asked that question, it would be leading and it would be trying to get them to do that. And they wouldn't allow that in court. Why would they allow that in a confession?
Right. Well, Nancy Grace has her own axe to grind here. You know, she's probably never seen a confession that she think is coerced. You know, and it's a question. We have motion hearings. These are Miranda Goodchild hearings. It's an issue of whether the person's right not to incriminate themselves has been overcome by, you know, police coercion. And you can coerce without threatening. In the old days, they'd, you know, slam you up against the wall and coerce a confession. And it's more manipulative. It's more psychological. But she, you know, I'm not weighing in. First of all, I can't. I'm still a prosecutor in the office, and this thing is pending in federal court. So I'm not weighing in on the ultimate issue. I might have an opinion. I don't know for sure whether this was coercive or not. And it still could be true confession, but still not admissible because it was coercive. Or it could be a false confession, which does happen. But for Nancy Grace to be not at all bothered by this, or to suggest that it's not even a proper issue to be brought before a court because it's so obvious that it's not coercive, that's a bunch of baloney. I mean, this was his own attorney set him up with a private investigator to get a confession out, presumably because they thought, you know, that's his best chance to cut a deal against Avery if he gave a more detailed confession.
Right, and how terrifying is that? How terrifying is that your attorney that you retained to help protect you, even if it's right, if it's given to you by the state, is on the side of the prosecution and is working with them along with an investigator that is part of the defense case, and they are trying to railroad you to admit to the crime so that they can aid the prosecution. Why are they not in jail?
Well, there was an ineffective assistance of counsel motion brought against the defense lawyer. Their client had earlier said that you know, he gave the police the initial version without before he was even retained, or before he was appointed, before the attorney was. So Brendan Dassey, after months of denying it, finally came out and said, after a lot of interviews that were suspect in terms of how aggressive they were, but still legit, I think, he did admit to the basics. But the attorney then, hearing that, makes the same mistake that everybody does, that, well, it must be absolutely true then. Even though my client's now saying that he didn't do it, that he just told the police that, even though he said he'd even take a lie detector test, his attorney, human nature, says, look, that's a bunch of baloney. Obviously, he did it. So I'm going to decide what's in the best interest of my client, even though he doesn't want to admit. I'm going to get him to admit by my own investigator, tricking him and being just a weird person to him, frankly, that was shown on Netflix. I'm going to get him to admit so then I can go to the state on his behalf and tell the state he has details. You can use them against Avery. You just give him a 20-year deal. That's a different kind of arrogance that is also problematic in this case. But so they did a great job, the Netflix documentarians, of bringing out that confession and that interrogation technique. I don't know, frankly. You know, that's a legal question, and it's not a black and white thing. When does it cross the line where it is too coercive, it is too manipulative, that it has overcome the person's ability to withstand law enforcement? It basically compelled them to give a statement. It's a tough issue. The court's going to have to wrestle with that one, the federal court.
There's a certain age. Isn't there some kind of law in effect to protect people that are mentally disabled or challenged? And is there any truth to the fact that Brendan Dassey is slow? I mean, is there, you know, he is a, I know Stephen Avery, I think they said at one point, had like a 72 IQ. What do they know about Brendan Dassey? Is he in that vein? Is he what they would refer to as mild retardation or a severe case? How does he fit into that altogether?
Yeah, well, he was in mainstream school, but there were probably some special ed classes. You know, I always, those IQ things, to put a number on these things, I never really bought into it. That the attorney said that Mr. Avery was a 70 IQ. Who knows where that came from? He's not. Mr. Avery's pretty sharp. I've come across him several times in other respects. And he's plenty street smart. He doesn't know education and schools and books. But Mr. Dassey, on the other hand, Brendan Dassey, the young man, you know, he's kind of like a zombie. I think how they portrayed him in the Netflix documentary is pretty close. You know, this is a kid, by the way, who did not have prior delinquencies. I mean, no prior crimes. He is not an evil person. Non-evil people do evil things, though, if Mr. Avery, Stephen Avery, is your role model. But, you know, like I say, it's not a black and white thing. So one of the things courts have to take into account is what you are getting at, Dave. It's what is the mental capacity? Are there any deficiencies? Are there any things that would make it easier for the police to overcome his will, including, you know, his intellectual capacity and his young age? I think he was 15. It's a balancing test. You test that against the police conduct to determine whether his confession was coerced and whether it's reliable and therefore admissible or not.
Well, wasn't his investigator coercive when he's telling him, I'm not going to help you unless you admit this. And if I don't help you, you're going to spend the rest of your life in prison. If I help you, I can get you out in 20 years. I mean, that's what Brendan says to his mom, too, that I don't want to spend the rest of my life in jail, Mom. You know, I can be out in 20 years kind of thing. You know, that sounds, to those of us on the outside, that still sounds like, oh, hell no. But if it's to the case where I'm not going to help you unless you draw, because they show all that evidence, and he's like, okay, draw the bed. Now show me how she's tied to the bed. That any fifth grader could draw that, just you telling me what you want me to draw. Draw the couch. Draw the person tied to a couch. How is that him doing it and not just appeasing this goofball that's asking him questions?
Oh, it was frightening. I mean, it was absolutely frightening.
So do you believe that what they did was wrong?
What his own attorney and his own private investigator did, there's no question that was wrong.
So do you believe that what they were getting from him was not real fact, it was what they were leading him to say and do?
The accuracy of his confession is something that I believe that's the way this murder happened, but it's almost not the issue, frankly, as far as the legal part of this, as to whether the confession, because who knows, ultimately. What is the legal part, though, is whether the police, not his own lawyer and his own investigator coerced out of him, but whether the police, but the authority of the state, coerced a confession that should not be able to be used in his trial. Because if he gets a new trial and they don't have the confession, I don't imagine, you know, they'll have much of a case against Brendan Dassey.
He gives this information, talks about this crime. He says that he was going to his uncle's house. He heard screams from outside, knocked on the door. His uncle comes to the door, brings him in. There is her first name is eluding me right now.
Teresa
Halbach. All right. And she's tied to the bed, chains shackling her legs to the bottom of the bed, hands tied with rope to the top of the bed. All the photographic evidence does not show chain markings or rope fibers on the headboards or the footboards. How does, you know, I've got seven kids. They bump against my headboard, I've got a scratch naturally. If somebody's sitting there struggling and fighting, or even if they're not, if they're forcibly being sexually abused, they're going to be moving and creating friction with rope and with chains through that. Why is there no sign of transference on the head or the footboard if this crime took place in that room?
Much less blood, right? From
We'll get to that. That seems like a crazy aspect as well, because that seems to jump from, well, it took place in the bedroom, to now they're saying, no, he actually killed her, stabbed her, killed her, and did all of this out in the garage. Right. And he was smart enough to lay down a sheet. Well, blood trickles through sheets. I don't know if people know that, but that's a fact. Blood will leave residual. And with that much violence, there should have been splatter. There should have been this, well, you know, he was seen with bleach, and he had bleach spots on his pants. I'm willing to bet there's a lot of weird spots on Stephen Avery's pants that are going to be there from many different things. The garage they showed to me did not look like it had been bleached at all. And they tore up concrete looking for blood. They could find nothing. In a violent act like that, there's no blood anywhere on site. How is that for you on that side of the law? I mean, there's a complete lack of evidence of a violent crime taking place on his property.
Well, it makes it makes you scratch your head, even, you know, I mean, it everybody wonders about that. My own, you know, my wife and kids, you know, you look at, well, how could it have happened there if there's no blood evidence? I will say this, they did have, almost a week, Mr. Avery did, to clean things up. Now, I'm no forensic expert. You know, my layman's opinion is the same, or suspicion is the same. With that kind of death, wouldn't there be some hair somewhere or some blood, or wouldn't there be transference on the like you were saying, from the rope? But I don't know. I you know, sometimes we think there's evidence everywhere, the fingerprint boogeyman, we call it, prosecutors, that, you know, people think there's going to be physical evidence all over the place, and a lot of times there isn't. There's not fingerprint evidence left. Now, this was brutal, brutal stuff.
But, Michael, if you're going to put me in prison for the rest of my life, and you already know you're walking a thin line, you're walking a razor's edge here because of what happened in the past, and you know that everybody's going to be watching this case, like the OJ trial, they're going to be watching this case. Wouldn't it behoove the prosecution and the defense to collaborate and do a test and take a chain and tie somebody to that bed with different gauge chain that might have been found on the property and move and see if, in fact, thrashing about, fighting, whatever, would have left any markings on that? That seems like a pretty simple experiment to try. And then look at the headboard. If somebody's tied to it, what would the effect of rope have on that headboard? I mean, that's just, before you put me away, please give me that. Just test this. Go look at it. There's no nicks and scrapes. Okay, so if you can go put chains on there and rattle that thing around, it leaves no marks. All right, then we can agree that maybe that could have taken place in that situation after all. But that there was no other DNA in the transference on the bed or the mattress at all, blood, sweat, tears, whatever, you know, that they were able to find. It just seems like there's a total lack of evidence missing from that part of it.
Well, and pointed out very well by the defense. You know, I mean, that was an issue that the jury had to think through. It was one issue in this case with all kinds of evidence and all kinds of things behind it, much of which the Netflix documentary did not show. But I really, on the specific point of why no evidence, physical evidence or much physical evidence, because there was, you know, there was the bullet in the car in the garage, and we'll get to that, I'm sure. But there it is very troubling and strange that there wouldn't have been, that there wasn't found that kind of evidence in the house. Whether, you know, there could have been more testing, we really are kind of armchair experts here, because there right. was a lot of testing, and I'm not sure what forensic testing would have shown, or if it wasn't in fact attempted, you know, and wasn't fleshed out with the defense even on the bed frame and that sort of thing. But the basic point is, yeah, it would be really surprising, just on a common sense view, I would think, that there's nothing in the way of DNA, blood, etc.
Michael, we have 10 seconds left in this segment. Can I ask one quick burning question? Everybody wants to know, were there lie detectors taken, lie detector tests by Brendan or by Stephen, and are they admissible in that kind of trial?
First question, I don't know. Second question is, even if they took them, they are not admissible in Wisconsin.
Right, so why bother giving them?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and I don't think they did take them, but because they're not very reliable. We may differ on that, but no, lie detector tests don't enter into the equation, not admissible in evidence that in Wisconsin or most states, I don't think.
Right. That's why I just had so many people ask tonight in social media emails and my own personal email. And if you have questions, you can email me dave@darknessradio.com. That's dave@darknessradio.com, or you can follow me on Twitter @darknessradio. Stay tuned. When we return, we'll continue to look at some of the flaws in this case. The Netflix documentary goes out of their way to make this look like Stephen Avery is an innocent man framed a second time. Dan O'Donnell joins Michael Griesbach and I as we discuss rebutting a murderer next on Coast to Coast AM.